he put himself out there. He put his sobriety out there. And even he acknowledged himself. It's like, well, you know, I have to be careful when I write this book because then I can't be seen, you know, at a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. When you have people self-titrating and self-adjusting and self-dosing, they're not sometimes in a state that they can figure it out for themselves. When is it helpful and when is it causing?
Here's an example where self-medication might not have been the best path.
Oh, I feel so bad about this because, like, I feel like with his addiction, he had no chance.
No chance.
Right? No chance because, like, he could find a healthcare provider that would prescribe him anything.
Yeah.
And then the other part, and I didn't bring this up when we went through the audiobook, but I was so nervous because this person worked so hard. And there was a couple statements there where he's like, I've overcome it.
We've done an episode for Matthew Perry, and unfortunately, he passed away. And it turned out that his, after the toxicology report from the coroner came out, that he was self-medicating, it would appear, with ketamine. So he was on ketamine therapy. He did talk about that, but his last therapy treatment was a week and a half before. And his therapy was IV, and this was in his stomach, so which meant he was taking probably sublingular tablets, which maybe we can talk a little bit about ketamine and its consequences.
Yeah, I think we should talk a bit about ketamine because, you know, in medicine, you know, we have a history of saying certain medications help with something, and these medications have substance use potential, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, you can find cartoons and pictures, you know, with Coca-Cola with cocaine in it. You can find alcohol for kids, you know, so they can, like, go to sleep at night when they're sick. You can find heroin to suppress cough, you know, in the 1930s. And in the 60s and 70s, there's some very good studies that looked at, you know, morphine and depressive symptoms. And it was almost like an on-off effect. You know, you go on morphine, depressive symptoms go away. And when the ketamine stuff came out, you can't ignore the data, right? You can't ignore the data where you have people on ketamine where all of a sudden their pain syndrome disappears and their depressive symptoms disappear almost immediately. And for me, the way that I justified it to myself that this was okay was just based on the traditional definition of addiction. So what's the traditional definition of addiction? It's the four C's, right? So cravings, compulsion to use, continued use despite negative consequences, and inability to cut down. The way ketamine was used in the pain world was you'd have these IV infusions, you know, a couple of times, and then you'd have like a few weeks of pain relief. The way it was used in the depression studies was that you'd have the ketamine maybe once a week, maybe twice a week or three times a week for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever the study is.
Yeah.
And then you would stop getting the ketamine and your depression would be better. And there's a lot of excitement and around these psychedelics, right? And we talked a bit about it and around, like, you know, for conditions that are very hard to treat, you know, around these things. And, you know, there's that pop psychology book by Michael Pollan about, you know, how to change your mind, which might be a fun thing to go through if you haven't gone through it yet. But the thing is, you know, like it's one of these things with these magic bullets, right? These magic bullets where, like, you know, I'm suffering, I'm struggling, I'm not doing well. Boom, let me take this. Where outside of a controlled environment, you know, when you have like someone say like myself managing my own things, I'm going to self-titrate to effect, right? So we see it for like ADHD, right? We see it for ADHD where someone's on ADHD med and then they'll take it, they'll need a higher dose. And then occasionally we run into a small subset of vulnerable people where they'll have manic-like symptoms or they'll have like bipolar-like symptoms or they'll just be like really depressed and almost like paranoid. And they're also convinced that this is the drug they need to function, right? Because they stop it, they'll have that crash afterwards. And the problem that I tend to see in the substance use practice that we have is that we sometimes run into people that like their ketamine state, that like their mushroom state better than the real world.
Right.
And they're convinced that by regularly being on ketamine, having like a nightly mushroom experience, microdosing mushrooms throughout the week.
Yes.
Right. That their life is better. And it might be. But the thing is that not everybody is like whatever me or you. There's some people where when they start to microdose or use, they start to think differently. They start to have different ideas, different things. And you can't predict what ideas come out there, right? Yeah. And it's just one of those things where I mean, we see it with bipolar disorder and hypomania. We see it with delusions and psychosis. We sometimes see it with depression or whatever it might be. And people start to have these worldviews that they believe is important for them. And their entire family, everyone around them, just sees them slowly deteriorating. And so for me, I think what's, and you know, you don't want to be critical, because if someone's been struggling with depression for 10, 20, 30 years, they can't get out of bed, the thoughts are just sort of negative, you don't want to withhold something that could help. And the hard part is, how do you prevent people that it could harm? And I think like there's this quote, I don't know where it's from, but there's this quote where it's like, you know, when the aristocrats or when the wealthy or when whatever get a cough, you know, the poor get pneumonia and die, right? Like, and so I think what's going to happen with this ketamine and this mushrooms is that, sure, in these controlled studies where they exclude complexity,
yeah,
you can't have all these different diagnoses or risk factors. They give in a controlled way, you're going to get these magical responses,
yes,
right? And then there's going to be a subset of people that are like, I would like to have these magical responses too.
Sure.
I don't have $20,000 to pay for this company to provide it for me. The government's not paying for it.
Right.
And I'm going to microdose or adjust or take it when I need it to self-regulate my thinking and all that kind of stuff. And some of them are going to develop problems with it, right? And so, and I think like, I mean, I don't want to say anything about Matthew Perry because I haven't gone through, it was very upsetting when he passed away. I didn't want to read about it. I didn't want to do any of that stuff around it. We went through his audiobook and he was so authentic there in that audiobook. That was just him. That was just him being completely himself, it felt like. Like he was just, there was almost like no filter, right? The way that he was talking. And so, but for example, if you think about Michael Jackson, right? Michael Jackson with like the propofol for sleep and all that stuff. This is someone who's very, very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And he has access to these drugs and he's seeing these healthcare providers that are almost in this thing where they're just giving whatever the person needs or wants for that symptom management. They're almost trapped in that loop. So I do think for the marginalized and the vulnerable, for people with some kind of biological or genetic vulnerability, and for the people that are wealthy, people that can fly down to Switzerland, Sweden, pay X thousands of dollars and get whatever treatment.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that have potential being harmed by this belief that the psychedelics and the ketamine can cure all these things.
Yeah.
The last comment I'll make just before I finish, I know you're listening very carefully and you've got all these thoughts that are there. I was very much on this thing around, well, like we need to give it a try. Like we're failing at curing depression. We're failing at all these things. And a friend of mine said to me, you're taking all of these patients that maybe have been using drugs. They believe there's something wrong inside of them and they're using drugs to try to fix it. And then you're telling them, I'm going to give you another drug that'll fix it.
Yeah.
And it's almost like he was also thinking of that vulnerable population. So I just think like, I just don't think we prepare ourselves for the unintended consequences. And I think that the signals are there early on, yet it gets lost in the whatever messaging.
I don't need to look to a celebrity story to talk about ketamine. I can look to myself. So I prior to crystal meth, I used a lot of ketamine. And ketamine's a very, and this was prior to, I'd never heard of it being used for depression or anything like that. I didn't know it was a medication. I used it recreationally.
I don't think it was used as medication back then. This is relatively novel. This is like, I think last 10,
okay.
10 maybe 15 years max, right? Okay. The signals were there.
All right.
But I might be wrong. Like, yeah. I think it was a tranquilizer of some kind, but I
right.
don't know.
Right. So, it's an anesthetic. It's still available as an anesthetic. They use it in, as I understand, they use it in military settings sometimes in the battlefields when they need an anesthetic immediately, but it's also used in different medical contexts as well. But so I used it recreationally. Now, one thing about ketamine that was really quite amazing is the development of tolerance for ketamine. So the tolerance in ketamine is unlike anything I've ever experienced or ever experienced after it with any drug that I've ever done. Because you could start off with doing $20 worth of ketamine would keep you going for, I don't know, 6 hours. Your first time, maybe.
Oh, the first time.
Yeah, maybe 6 or 8 hours.
Again, well, what does keep going mean? Like, you just feel better? Like,
no,
like
you're high. You're high from it. You're
what does that mean? Like, you're just, like, lightheaded? You're, like, smiling? It's like a buzz?
Well, okay. So, ketamine is, there's a lot of different ways of looking at ketamine, which is some people use ketamine to get into what's called a K-hole, which is sort of an out-of-body type experience. Other people just feel it to sort of numb the situation. You know,
numb the negativity,
not numb the negativity, just numb everything that's going on. You're sort of like, how could I,
you're in like a detached state, like
you can, a bit of a detached state.
You can notice it a bit better. You can observe it a bit better. You don't get so invested in what's around you.
Right. If you got lots of shit going down in your life, that's not working out very well for you. Ketamine is a good drug to numb.
It allows you to like zoom out and then pick what you, it's almost like a super mindfulness thing.
It allows you to be entertained by the sound of your furnace.
Oh, so it makes things more enjoying.
It makes enjoyable. Things that are otherwise mundane, entertaining. Okay.
At least that's what you found.
That's what I found.
So when you spend the $20, you had 6 hours of having time of your life.
Sure.
But if you looked at what you were doing during that time.
Nothing.
Probably not that much fun.
Yeah, nothing. And on the outside, it's not accomplishing pretty well, probably nothing. Now, ketamine is often a drug that's used with other drugs. So when I started using it, it was with other drugs.
Like a coming down kind of thing? Like you're coming down?
It could be. It's a good thing to come down with, but also it's sort of an enhancer for people that do ecstasy and things like that. A lot of ravers do ketamine. It's very big in the rave scene. It's very big in the rave scene.
Was that part of the scene you were part of?
It was once upon a time.
I shouldn't be asking all these questions.
No, you can. Yeah. That's what we're here for. But the point about tolerance is that take that $20 and let's say you do ketamine every day for 3 months. That $20, I've done $2,000 worth of ketamine in a day.
So it's almost like you have to like use it like once a week. If you use it once a week, maybe you still get a little bit of that high.
Sure.
But if you're using it daily and just trying to get that state constantly, right. you never get there.
Right. So why I bring that point up, and I think it's relevant to what we're talking about, is that self-titration, that's the word that we're talking about, where you're like getting a medication to a level that you're comfortable with. Can you imagine a drug that you develop that much tolerance to that a patient would be self-regulating the amount? Impossible, right? And with ketamine, so now full disclosure, I did a powder. So it was a white powder to me. I know it is a liquid as well, but I never did it as a liquid. It's a liquid in its pre-state before it gets baked and it's turned into a powder. So it's often imported in a liquid state. It's pharmaceutically, it's a liquid state when it comes in.
So you just sort of like mix it with water and drink it, or what would you? How would you take?
No. So for me, no, it's a powder. No, it's a powder that you snort.
Oh, you snort it. Okay.
Snort it.
Okay.
So, and probably a lot of the problem with why you need to do $2,000 of it, and you may be not in any of the current
formats. Oh, because you're not absorbing at all.
You're not absorbing at all.
Yeah, it's on very poor absorption through intranasally.
You're done.
I got it.
You get to the point where your entire nasal system, you can't breathe. Yeah. You know, you're just, if you outwardly have a patient where they've got these caked up nostrils, white stuff there, and nothing is going in. Right. Yeah. So that's one of the problems with it. So I'm not sure if it's the same thing in the sense of if with these other more modern treatments, but that's one thing that I noticed, which would frighten the hell out of me if somebody's like self-regulating to say, yeah, so the ketamine may be at certain doses meant, picking up what you're saying, is meant to, you know, help with your depression at a certain level and to help with your depression, but it's not going to mean you're not going to get frustrated driving down the road if somebody cuts you off. If you need enough ketamine to make that happen, that's a whole nother thing. Right. So it's like, if life still sucks, but maybe it helped with your depression.
Well, no. So the whole thing with the when you're depressed, you have views about yourself and the world that may have truth to it, but they're amplified and they're a little bit rigid sometimes, right? Like it's my fault. Like I deserve these things. The world is not fair. I mean, it's more complicated than that. And then when someone's depression clears, they have more flexibility in thinking, right? And sort of they're able to think like, that person cut me off. Maybe they've had a rough day. Maybe they're just a crappy driver.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe they're better able to let it go, right? And so I think like there is something to be said for treating someone's depression, right? And we don't want to take that away. The challenge is that some people are looking for something that might not be that depression being treated. So for example, there's some people we see that have chronic emptiness, mm-hmm. chronic fears of abandonment.
Sure.
They have this like skin that's like they feel all those things personally. They'll go between loving and hating you in some way. They may be quick to anger. They may be quite impulsive. And some of these symptoms may at times overlap with depression, but they're not depression, right? And so what sometimes happens is when people are trying to microdose or they may be targeting symptoms that would require skills, right, to overcome. And
so if what I'm hearing you right is that sometimes they're microdosing to perhaps deal with some characteristics of personality disorders as opposed to depression.
Well, that's what I was listening, right? But it doesn't necessarily have to be that, right?
It could be that.
It could be complex trauma. It could be like whatever it might be.
And with the person that we did talk about a lot, and I know you don't want to talk about him specifically, but you know, we did get very deep into his biography.
He put it all in the autobiography.
He put it all there. His feeling of emptiness, his feeling of abandonment.
He had all those feelings. I don't know anything about his diagnoses, right? Like other than what's in the audiobook. Yeah, other ones in the audiobook.
Of course.
Yeah. And I don't think it's ethical for me to try to make a diagnosis about a celebrity in any kind of way. Although I guess we do. I mean, it's okay to talk about addiction in general or this. I feel very uncomfortable in that possibility. But the point that I really wanted to make here is that yes, ketamine, psilocybin, all these things have the potential to be transformative medical care, right? ADHD, the medications change so many people's lives, right? People that we know and love dearly, right? It's changed their lives, those medications. And when you have people self-titrating and self-adjusting and self-dosing, they're not sometimes in a state that they can figure it out for themselves. When is it helpful and when is it causing harm?
Right. And
the same thing happened with the pain meds back.
Sure.
Back when that was there.
Sure. Right? And I'm not trying to get you into an unethically comfortable area, but I mean, if there's anybody that, you know, Matthew Perry, what do you want your legacy to be? It's like how I helped people with their addiction. That's what he wanted his legacy to be. So I don't think I'm really, hopefully I'm not outside of comfort zone by saying that, you know, now that he turned out to be self-medicating with this medication, is there anything to take away from that might be helpful to other people that self-medication, here's an example where self-medication might not have been the best path.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. And I think the message in my mind for this is, you know, just because something is like a medication, right? It doesn't mean it's always good for you.
Right.
Just because something is natural and it's from the earth, it doesn't mean that it's always good for you. Just because something helps somebody else, it doesn't mean it's always always good for you. And I would hope. I hope I would never end up in a situation like that. And if I do end up in a situation the way that Matthew Perry did, prior to it, I hope that I'd be able to look at my view of the situation. I hope I'd be able to turn to people that I love and care about, or people I know that care about me, and say, hey, what do you think? Is this working? Is it not? What's happening with me in some way? Maybe I'll go see a healthcare provider. Maybe I'll do sort of a few scales. But I would want multiple avenues of assessments of the situation so I can figure out, is this treatment actually helping me or not?
Yeah.
Because I think like when we're depressed, you know, we can't assess reality in an objective way. And even though whatever we're saying feels true, just like when we're in this state of like intoxication withdrawal, right? It's going to be a little bit different than what it actually, even when we're at our best, right? Like you've seen me, I'm always like self-critical. Oh, did I do this right? Did I do that right? Like how many times have I said like, oh, I think I did a horrible job there. And like, look, you've gone above and beyond the average physician in that case. Right. And so like our perception of things, if we just take an isolation in our mind, we don't know if that final product is going to be accurate. Right.
Right.
And then when you have something that has to happen in the darkness, right. Cause you're not going to find a prescriber that's going to give you this much ketamine and say that, oh, just take what you need and figure out what the right amount is, right? Or like a whole bag of mushrooms or like 2 ounces of weed or cannabis or like, you know, like here's like, what's it called? I don't, my point is that I think if I can build
on that and saying that unless you're Matthew Perry, unless you're Michael Jackson, and unless, you know, you've got this unlimited wealth and notoriety. And in fact, where I really feel for Matthew as somebody myself who tells their story effectively for a living, that's pretty much what I do. He put himself out there. He put his sobriety out there. And even he acknowledged himself. It's like, well, you know, I have to be careful when I write this book because then I can't be seen, you know, at a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. His words, he doesn't want to be seen walking down the middle of the street yelling at somebody after he writes this book. So I feel for him because then who is he going to ask? Who are the people that guy's going to go to?
No, I feel so bad about this because I feel like with his addiction, he had no chance.
No chance.
Right? No chance because he could find a healthcare provider that would prescribe him anything.
Yeah.
He can go into a 30-day program, give him 30K. There was one thing in his book. He took a 200K flight down to Switzerland and then got whatever the treatment
he
was.
He's never been higher in his whole life than at that treatment center.
Yeah. The doctor here is like, no, it's not indicated. Just gets on a private jet right away and flies. So I think the wealthy with access, they had no chance there. And then the other part, and I didn't bring this up when we went through the audiobook, but I was so nervous because this person worked so hard and there was a couple statements there where he's like, I've overcome it, you know, and I think about, you know, who we've worked with or even ourselves in our life when we've done something that was so hard, right? We've gotten over a habit and we're doing there's so much shame when it comes back.
100%.
There's so much shame and you know, it doesn't matter how safe of a space I try to create, how much I tell people, you know, like I care about you. I accept you. I just want you to come back. I don't care if you're drinking or not, just come back.
Yeah.
When the drinking starts again, there's so much shame that they don't want to see you.
Yeah.
Right. They just want to you're just like, you're almost like waiting. You're waiting for and you don't know how bad it's going to get. Like sometimes it's when they come back to the hospital, sometimes when a friend brings them in, and sometimes something bad happens, right? And they don't make it, you know? And so when someone says that I'm now well and I've overcome it, how are they going to get help if they get sick again?
Well, I mean,
I don't even know if he was sick. Like maybe he thought he was taking medicine. Maybe he thought he's like self-treating his depression. Right. Mm-hmm. And there was a thing about the,
well, Vicodin's medicine too.
Yeah, I was going to say about the, was it like, I forget what it was. I don't know if it was
his whole problem was Vicodin, right?
And that was before, right?
Yeah. I understand. But his original problem was Vicodin.
Oh, it was a prescribed medication, yeah.
It's a prescribed medication. Fair enough.
The other thing I was just going to say is I don't know if it was like pickleball or he played some sport, right?
Yeah, pickleball.
This person was an elite junior national athlete in Canada at tennis. And with his desire to be the best, I can imagine him being competitive at any sport.
He was on testosterone treatments at the time as well.
Oh, he's on testosterone. Yeah. That's why I don't go through this stuff.
Yeah.
Because then your mind starts thinking, your mind starts wondering, you come to these conclusions that probably aren't true.
Right.
But it's such a sad story. I don't know.
And I think it is about, you know, the sort of the box that folks with privilege get themselves into. I mean, not to just talk about celebrities, but I mean, look at Michael Jackson, right? So, you know, Michael Jackson hadn't been able to go to the bathroom on his own for years, it said.
What do you mean?
He had to be catheterized.
No, you're kidding.
No. So that's why
that a side effect of? Was that the ketamine? Was he on ketamine too? I have no idea.
I don't know if that
But he had to be catheterized. Oh my goodness, poor guy.
So that's why he had a doctor full time to do this for him, right? So, you know, but if you've got, you know, $200,000 a month, which is what, you know, I forget the name of his doctor, was paid to work for him, right? Just to take care of him 24 hours a day, right?
Yeah.
And
it's hard to really provide best practices.
I mean, the fact is you're not supposed to have propofol in your house, right? So, you know, you're not supposed to need that every night to go to sleep. But if you have enough enablers and enough people around you to, you know, there is no out for that.
Yeah,
who is he going to go to then?
I don't know.
Dr.
The right
Conrad
way to say
is the name of the guy that
I just don't think, I mean, not that I don't know what the answer is. I don't want to ever pretend that. I know what the answer is because I'm still learning and evolving and growing.
Yeah.
I don't think wealthy people get good addiction care. I don't think people without means get good addiction care. I don't think there's a single place that if I had a family member struggling with mental health addiction, I could say, hey, go there. They'll take care of you.
Right.
Right. It's almost like you have to prepare them. Oh, you get this from this place, this from this place. Go here, but watch out. This program's not going to work for you. You have to do this stuff first, you know, before you can get that benefit. When you go there, I don't know, like I just, and then when I see these magic bullets come out.
Yeah.
I think about the wealthy where they just want to spend 20-30K, get this treatment, get better.
Yeah.
And then I think about the people that don't have access to it, that'll find a dealer to get it where there's uncertainty around what's in the product.
Yeah.
Cause people, it's so hard to be in their own skin, right? And they'll do anything to try to feel better.
Well, ketamine, as I understand it, is completely awash in California right now is availability. There's ketamine is available through multiple channels.
What do you mean?
It's available. It's not, you don't have to go to a drug dealer to get ketamine. So there are all kinds of providers that will provide you ketamine.
Like a doctor?
Like a doctor.
No. Can I is the point where I can just walk to a drugstore and pick some up, or do I have to have it prescribed?
As the way I understand it, from what I have read and heard, the ketamine availability in California is similar to what the mushroom availability is here.
So they have just stores you can walk in and just pick it up?
Pretty much. Yeah. Not legally. It's not lawful.
Oh, okay. When you go to those stores, but they have like these like cleaner things or those things, but they're really. Mushrooms, yeah, technically legal, but
I can go to the mushrooms. Our mushroom store sells ketamine too.
Oh, it does?
Yes. Yeah.
Just for fun, where is this?
The Shroom Store. We did an episode on the Shroom Store.
Where is this? Kensington?
Yeah. Kensington. Yeah. It's like the $300. Check it out.
You can just go buy ketamine. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, and maybe the end game is that, drugs with abuse potential will be everywhere. Maybe that's what the end game is. And you're seeing it with the medical profession, what we're providing. And I think at the end of the day, like, how do you pick up people's agency? And how do you help those that are vulnerable, right? That's the part that I don't know. And if it has to be a world where everything's available, maybe it has to be a world where everything's available. But I think we need to figure out how to protect the vulnerable, right? I mean, we think about alcohol and...
Well, how good of a job did we do protecting the vulnerable there?
No, well, I mean, we've almost accepted it as a part of life, right? Accepted it as a part of life. I don't know the data. I don't know the data, but it's... I just wanted to bring it up because I think, like... there's not enough safeguards in place to protect the vulnerable. I don't think there's enough education in place. And from my end, you know, the magic with these psychedelic type medications like the ketamine and the mushrooms is that it creates a flexibility in thinking. And sometimes it creates a state where you can get this transformative idea, like this transformative moment where all of a sudden white is black, black is white. All of a sudden your whole narrative of your life goes from like hopelessness and being a victim to being empowered and ready to change the world. But then there's the people where that may not happen to, and how do we help them if they want it? How do we make sure that we're not the ones causing? Ability, right? I don't have the ability to ask the questions and get the data and then spread the message.
Right. So not to get too deep into the academic part of this, but I think this would be a good opportunity for us to put that bell curve up again. I don't know if you remember
but that's the public health one.
Where it's like the more supply, more problems type bell curve.
Yeah. So this is a well-known public health figure that's in the shape of a U.
Yes.
And it has to do with...
Is that applicable here? Sorry. To our conversation, do you think?
It would be, but it's applicable at a public health level.
Sure. So would speak to why you don't want perhaps the government providing ketamine available at more available to people or involved at all.
Yeah, you might not want the government giving ketamine free to everybody in the world.
Right.
Okay. And you might not want the government making sure that everyone who has ketamine is in jail and whatever
right.
it might be.
Right. So that
this no, curve. I mean, we can show you, but the thing to remember with this U is that this is a public health figure, right? And there's different
measuring things. Harms.
there's different things when you think about the individual in front of you.
Sure.
Right? That's the part that I think gets mixed. Okay. Because what ends up happening is that you think like public health data, individual intervention, public, like it gets mixed and matched sometimes. And I think that's what's happening with certain things that are going on. So I think that use important. Let's put it up there. Let's have a link that describes what it is, because I'm clearly not doing a good job of it.
No, I think you are.
Prohibition versus like unlimited access, both have problems, and there's some sweet spot in the middle.
Right.
And when we were at CSAM, and the Vancouver Island Public Health Medical Officer said, we're not doing a good job with any of the drugs.
Right.
It sort of tells you that it's almost like this theory.
Right.
It's like a theory that we've not actually figured out how to apply it.
What was the first line that you said? The rich get cold, and
I don't know where it came from.
Okay,
but when the wealthy get a cough, the poor die of pneumonia.
Right. Okay. So which speaks to perhaps a great individual solution for one person, ends up, you know, killing the masses because it's poorly applied. Is that kind of the concept?
No. The concept is that we roll something out.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe it harms a couple of people.
Yes.
Right. Of people who are privileged like us, you know, like people that don't have that privilege, is going to harm them so much more.
Right.
So for example, when the cost of food goes up, my life sucks a little bit.
Yeah.
It probably sucks a lot for other people. Yeah. My mortgage rate goes up, my life's affected a little bit.
Yeah.
Other people, it destroys them in terms of paying the bills and stuff like that. That's where that point I came. Major comorbidities in a very controlled environment. And so whatever harms they capture there are going to be amplified for the vulnerable people in society.
Yeah.
We see with SSRIs, we see with antipsychotics, we see it with all this stuff. So I don't know. I just think like, I don't know what's going to happen here. I don't know where it's going to go. I just think it's important to have that out there, that like, it's not a solution to everything.
Yep.
No, I think psychedelics and ketamine.
That's good. I think that was a useful conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for watching. If you like what you saw, please feel free to like and subscribe. That way you'll get notified when we come out with new content. We try to come out with new content about every week or so. So anyway, thanks again and see you soon.